We are the party of Roosevelt. We are the party of Kennedy. So don't tell me the Democrats won't defend this country. Don't tell me the Democrats won't keep us safe. The Bush-McCain foreign policy has squandered the legacy that generations of Americans, Democrats and Republicans, have built. And we are here to restore that legacy.
Everyone is calling Barack Obama's acceptance speech last night a historic moment, but where in history should we situate it? We are joined now by Ted Widmer, who was Bill Clinton's foreign policy speechwriter from 1997 to 2001. Mr. Widmer is also a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the book, The Arc of Liberties, America and the World, published by Hill and Wang. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Can you give us any idea of how much time goes into preparing, reviewing, editing, and practicing a major speech like this?
I would imagine many weeks went into that speech. They knew it was coming. They had a lot of time to think about it. It did have a lot of current politics in it, but I think they were also trying to do certain historic things, and I think they largely pulled it off. It seems like it was a huge hit.
You say they. I've heard that Senator Obama has written most of his own speeches. Not in the case of something as important as this one?
Well, they're always collaborative, and it's a difficult business to figure out who writes what exactly. I mean, often one person here will add a line, another person there will add a paragraph, and the end is usually a composite. But I do think it's very important to give the politician the credit, because even speechwriters who contribute words are trying to write in that person's voice, and it is his vision, and he certainly wouldn't say anything he didn't want to say, so I think that's appropriate.
Many nomination speeches seem to lay out a conception of what the government should be. Kennedy had the New Frontier, Roosevelt had the New Deal, Reagan had the American Compact, Clinton had the New Covenant. Did you see anything like that in Obama's speech last night?
No, and that was interesting. I read all of those speeches, and we had heard that certain ones, Reagan and Clinton and Kennedy especially, were on the minds of Obama and the speechwriters. But there was no two-word soundbite like that, and maybe it's not needed. Clinton's New Covenant vanished nearly as quickly as it appeared, so maybe we're past that two-word soundbite. But that was the pattern, the new something, and we didn't. It was all about new ideas, but there was no two-word soundbite like that.
And the tone tended to be less lofty than what we've come to expect.
You know, it was a surprise. I think he may have been brilliant to do that, because he certainly can achieve loftiness. We've heard that throughout the campaign. In 2004, he was very lofty. And there have been feelings that there wasn't a lot of substance. It was just all rhetoric. And last night, he went pretty deeply into substance. So it may not be a speech for the history books, and that is something I always try to think about. But it may have taken him that much further to election. And let's face it, election is what we're all thinking about right now.
Not a speech for the history books, because it didn't have any of those lofty phrases or slogans that people come to remember, to associate
right.
with the speech.
That's right. I mean, usually the ones that are remembered have unusually beautiful language or shocking new thoughts in them. And this was a lot of political red meat. I mean, it was attractively presented, but it was a political speech, definitely.
Many commentators said that the Democratic Convention was all about getting the American people familiar with Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any historical precedent in the modern era of the public feeling that they don't know a candidate this late in the game?
Well, I mean, if you go into the pre-television era, I'm sure there was a lot more of this feeling, but it's a bit unusual. I mean, I think with Michelle Obama especially, that really was her public debut in a way that we haven't seen for a while. And even in 92, with Hillary and Bill Clinton rising quickly into prominence, there was a feeling that we knew more about them through the campaign than I think the American public feels now. But I think they performed admirably. I think they achieved everything they wanted to this week. The party's been reunited, and now Michelle Obama is well known, and I think they end the week on a pretty strong note.
Another criticism of Obama is that he hadn't been specific enough, but that wasn't the case with this speech. In fact, he laid out a number of specific policy proposals. Is that unusual in a nomination speech?
I would say yes. As I look through the three we talked about, the Clinton, Reagan, JFK, they were more about the spirit they were bringing to the campaign and not small bore political ideas. And I think we did go a little more deeply into that last night. Clinton in 92 characteristically did also talk about the things Democrats care about, education, health care, the economy, more than anything. So in a way, it felt a lot like a Clinton speech to me last night.
In fact, he was practically saying it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah, he was.
Has the war in Iraq been relegated to the back burner?
I don't think so, but I think the economy did rise up to the front burner this summer. Food prices and fuel prices going up dramatically, and fuel prices are a little bit down, but there's a shakiness out there. There's a feeling we don't quite know where we're going economically. That's very important for Democratic voters.
He did say that he would end the war in Iraq responsibly. This is an area where the Democrats have been relatively vulnerable, the whole matter of national security. Do you think that he has protected the Democrats from those kinds of attacks from Republicans?
Well, that was another strong point last night, that he spoke aggressively about, don't tell me that we're the party of Kennedy, the party of Franklin Roosevelt. And I thought that was a healthy rebuttal, because Democrats have been losing on national security for a long time, I mean, since 1980 at least, when Reagan spoke very effectively about it. And we all remember Dukakis in the tank. And Clinton was able to parry some of those concerns. I mean, I was involved, but I feel like he ran a generally successful foreign policy. But that feeling is still in the air, that if you're worried about defense issues and national security, that you vote Republican. And if you pull the camera back and you look back 100 years or so, the Democrats have had every bit as successful a foreign policy as Republicans, and often more so.
But Obama is a lot more vulnerable than John Kerry, and we saw what happened to John Kerry in the last election.
I mean, no one was ever on stronger footing, seemingly, than John Kerry. And exactly, he turned out he was much more vulnerable than most of us thought.
I'm talking with Ted Widmer, who is a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation and a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton, wrote on foreign policy from 1997 to 2001. We have another clip from Obama's speech last night where he talks about the past 8 years. Maybe we should listen to that.
Tonight I say to the people of America, to Democrats and Republicans and independents across this great land, enough! This moment. This moment. This election is our chance to keep, in the 21st century, the American promise alive. Because next week in Minnesota, the same party that brought you two terms of George Bush and Dick Cheney will ask this country for a third. And we are here. We are here because we love this country too much to let the next 4 years look just like the last eight. On November 4th, we must stand up and say, eight is enough.
He hit that catchphrase, eight is enough, pretty hard there. Do you think he has a unique rhetorical style?
Well, first of all, I just want to say I'm so happy to have the TV show Eight is Enough back in the national conversation. I loved that. He does. I think he has an interesting way of speaking. He uses pauses beautifully. He inflects his voice more than most people. If you listen to McCain, he has a pretty flat voice and very few oratorical gestures. Obama moves his hands around. He's like an actor up there. And I think that is an older-fashioned kind of rhetoric that's pleasing. I think that's one of the reasons voters have really responded to him.
Well, we had similar oratorical styles. Not the same style, but people who really communicated well with Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And that may have added to their appeal as well. Do you see Obama's style as reminiscent of any other American president?
Well, I mean, certainly the Obama campaign has always compared itself to Kennedy from pretty early on. And there is...
And Ted Sorensen, one of his major supporters, has compared him to Kennedy. He said he was the first politician since Kennedy that he felt that kind of connection to.
Mm-hmm. And there are some grounds for that comparison. I mean, there are also some reasons that it doesn't work at all. But similar age, Obama's actually a little bit older than Kennedy was when he ran in 1960, and they're both senators. And I think they do a lot with a little, to be honest. I mean, he asks a powerful question and lets the audience think about it, but doesn't always go into the tiny details of political action, which is more what you get in a Clinton speech. These are our five options. This is the one we're going to choose, and this is what. I mean, it's a little more one person thinking through political subtlety with another. And with Kennedy and with Obama, I think you get big questions going to the core of who we are as a people, and that too can be very effective.
Well, in his speech at the convention, former Vice President Al Gore compared Barack Obama to Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can listen a little to a little bit of that clip.
Before he entered the White House, Abraham Lincoln's experience in elective office consisted of 8 years in his state legislature in Springfield, Illinois, and one term in Congress, during which he showed courage and wisdom to oppose the invasion of another country in a war that was popular when it was started, but later condemned by history. The experience that Lincoln's supporters valued most in that race was his powerful ability to inspire hope in the future at a time of impasse. He was known chiefly as a clear thinker and a great orator with a passion for justice and a determination to heal the deep divisions of our land. He insisted on reaching past partisan and regional divides to exalt our common humanity.
Isn't it a bit dangerous to compare a politician to Abraham Lincoln? That's like comparing a playwright to Shakespeare.
It is. I mean, in this case, we might give him a pass because he's from the same state. And he announced his candidacy in Springfield, Illinois. But yes, no one really lives up to Lincoln. Although it does prompt one thought, which is that Lincoln rose up as an orator. He was famous for the Lincoln-Douglas debates and then his... president giving famous speeches. It is a little more like Lincoln than Kennedy.
Well, when you review most presidential acceptance speeches, regardless of party, you often find references to Abraham Lincoln. Why is that?
Well, he's the best. He's the best speaker in our history. He wrote his own speeches, and I mean, we don't really know much about their delivery, or I mean, we can read newspaper accounts, but he wasn't so exciting giving the speeches, apparently, but the words just stay forever because they go the deepest into who we are. They're modest and ambitious at the same time. They tell very difficult truths about us. They're not full of political platitudes, which, let's face it, most Democratic and Republican speeches are. And so he's the gold standard, and he probably always will be.
Do we have a record of his acceptance speech?
I don't remember if there. I mean, it was in Chicago, but at that time, candidates did not usually participate in the political maneuvering to get someone the nomination. They were supposed to be above it all. So I don't remember if he gave them, but I'm inclined to think not. But I honestly can't tell you. The first one to appear in person very famously was Franklin Roosevelt in 1932, who also went to Chicago by airplane. That was the first, too.
Because before that, well, not before FDR, but for a long time, it was really difficult to travel. It took days and days to get from one city to another.
Right.
This must have been a pretty messy thing. I can't imagine what it would be like if everybody had to pick up from Denver and go to Minneapolis, St. Right. Paul in a day. Several television commentators last night said that Senator Obama's acceptance represented a historical bookend with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. That's putting a lot of pressure on Obama as well, isn't it?
It is, and I don't think, I mean, I enjoyed the speech a lot last night. I think it was very good politics. I think he'll come out of this week doing better in the polls, but if you were to ask me honestly, does it belong in the pantheon of greatest American speeches, I would say no, because it isn't quite as soaring as King's speech in 63 was. I mean, it's not even close. It was a very good speech politically, I mean, superb, but I don't think it's one of the all-time great American speeches, and I don't say that in any spirit of disapproval of what he did. I think he was very smart, gave the perfect speech, but I just don't think it soared the way King's did at the Lincoln Memorial.
Well, this was intended to serve a purpose, to answer all the criticisms that he's been receiving and
exactly.
any he might receive in the future,
exactly.
and then try to move ahead after that.
Right. Right.
The location of the acceptance speech in a large stadium was meant to evoke Kennedy's 1960 nomination address.
Right.
So he is aware of these historical precedents.
Very much so.
Now, John McCain has just selected Alaska Governor Sarah Palin to be his running mate. Do you see any other historical parallels between that and Walter Mondale's selection of Geraldine Ferraro, the last time a woman was on a major presidential ticket? Or is that just coincidental? Because in this case, it's obviously, at least in part, a way to attract disaffected supporters of Hillary Clinton.
Very likely. But it's just a sign also that the wheels turn even for the Republican Party. And the obvious parallel is Mondale and Ferraro in 1984. But these are different circumstances, and I think her youth is also very important.
Mm-hmm.
She's in her early 40s, and so she complements McCain nicely that way. And she's a maverick, like most of America. I just spent the last half an hour Googling her, which is how I found out a bit more about her. And she isn't a typical Republican. I think that will help him also.
Although in the past, it was usually the choice of a running mate was intended to balance the ticket, as they
mm-hmm.
said. Geraldine Ferraro was from New York, an attempt to get more votes from the East. JFK chose Lyndon Johnson, a rival, somebody he'd had a lot of run-ins with before.
Right.
And that really worked well. He delivered Texas, a very large state, and much of the South as well. We have an odd situation here. We have two vice presidential candidates from very small states, Delaware. Alaska may be large in landmass, but it sure doesn't have much of a population.
Right, right.
Do you see this as a change in the way American politics is being conducted, or is this just one of those oddities of this season?
I think it's one of those oddities of this season, but it shows that personality is extraordinarily important, and it could well be that in 4 years we go back to Pennsylvania, Texas, California, I mean, the big states that you have to win to win the whole thing. But if there were more naked state-by-state calculations, Romney probably would have been it, not for Massachusetts, but for Michigan, or Ridge for Pennsylvania. But it seems like personality is important, and all of these very subtle calculations of how truly conservative is McCain. Well, now he's picked someone who is deeply esteemed by the Christian right. And at the same time, she has thwarted the Republican Party in her own state and large-scale oil companies in her own state. So she has a little bit of that maverick thing that McCain people like.
Let's listen to a portion of Senator Obama's speech last night where he directly attacked John McCain.
I don't believe that Senator McCain doesn't care what's going on in the lives of Americans. I just think he doesn't know. Why else would he define middle class as someone making under $5 million a year? How else could he propose hundreds of billions in tax breaks for big corporations and oil companies, but not one penny of tax relief to more than 100 million Americans? How else could he offer a health care plan that would actually tax people's benefits? Or an education plan that would do nothing to help families pay for college? Or a plan that would privatize Social Security and gamble your retirement? It's not because John McCain doesn't care. It's because John McCain doesn't get it.
So I suppose this is a way of stating a major theme of the coming campaign, that mm-hmm. John McCain is out of touch.
Right.
Do you think that is an effective approach?
Extremely. I think it's the theme. And I enjoyed hearing him go right into jobs and education, healthcare. I mean, I think those are the bread and butter issues that are going to win this election. So when I was saying it didn't soar like a Martin Luther King speech, I wasn't saying that in disapproval. I think he's going right into the guts of the campaign, and that's what he needs to win. I mean, no one remembers a beautifully written speech of a losing candidate. I mean, there are one or two, William Jennings Bryan, but not too many. We remember the winner speeches, so we've got to win the election first.
Out of touch covers a number of different areas for him in attacking John McCain. It can refer to John McCain's age without actually saying anything about it. It refers to the houses and some of the other things that have come up, to the fact that, you know, John McCain is a very, very wealthy man. But in the end, do you think that this is something that resonates with the public?
I do. Yeah, I think it's a very shrewd line of attack, and it has the advantage of being true. McCain is extremely old by the standards of candidates running for office, and there were subtle ways to say that. At one point in the speech, he mentioned that McCain had been in there for 26 years, and it's a long time. And I think it will resonate with younger voters, certainly, who obviously are for Obama already. But I think it'll just deepen that feeling that we've been with a certain kind of government for a long time. I mean, both Republicans and Democrats, I think, feel that government isn't working very well in Washington. And it's arguing for change is one of the best ways to win an election, and always has been.
Well, we have the Republican convention next week, and John McCain isn't known as one of the greatest public speakers. If you were working on his speech, what would you try to do to get around that?
Well, I do think history works. I mean, I say that as someone who's gone back to history. I teach history now. And
at Brown?
Well, I actually direct a research center in early American history, but yeah, at Brown University. And I taught history before I was a speechwriter, and I personally love hearing the bits from Lincoln or Jefferson or Theodore Roosevelt that enliven any political utterance. And I think they could do worse than to go movingly back into American history, but I think they also need to find some courage, and they need to move beyond George Bush, which will not be easy with him out there. But I think McCain really needs to chart a new course if he has any chance of winning the election, because I don't think the public want four more years of what we've seen for the last 8 years. So he's got to say some new things, and you need new ideas to say new things. And so we'll see. I mean, it's possible they have some, but there haven't been too many so far.
Ted Widmer directs the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University. He was a foreign policy speechwriter and senior advisor to President Clinton, and he's a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. His latest book is Arc of the Liberties, America and the World, published by Hill and Wang. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.